A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us a prompt that starts with a confession. He says he's literally the worst at this, which is precisely why he's asking. He chronically underestimates how long things take. Errands, business tasks, everything. And he wants to master what he calls the practice of never being pressed for time or in a hurry.
That's a good phrase. Never being pressed for time.
It is. And he connects it to something we've talked about before, the concept of margin or buffer in preparedness, drawn from his own chaotic life experience over the past few years, the unplanned move, the war, the rest of it. He says the same principle applies to scheduling. Then he brings in his late grandfather, Fred Rosehill, who had a maxim his mother was fond of reminding him, "If you're not 15 minutes early, you're late," which he heard about 50 times when he was 16 and didn't always want to hear it, but he figures it's probably a pretty good general principle. Building in buffer should be the default position, not a nice to have.
And then he names the objection, which is the part I really like.
Right. The productivity-obsessed retort, and he includes himself in this, is, if I build 15 minutes of buffer into 4 meetings a day and I don't need any of them, I've suddenly lost an hour of my workday. But he suspects that's short thinking. Those 50 minutes are often productive because you have a few minutes to actually take notes or write out a plan for the next task, instead of being hurried around. And then his actual question, how do you actually operationalize and apply this principle in practice?
So, this isn't a theory question. This is someone saying, I believe the principle, I can feel that it's right, and I still can't do it.
That's exactly what it is. And I should say, I've thought about this a lot. Partly because I'm a sloth and everyone assumes I have some mystical relationship with time, which I don't. What I have is a very low tolerance for feeling rushed, and I've built my entire approach to scheduling around avoiding that feeling. So let's dig into why your brain systematically underestimates task duration and what to actually do about it.
So let's start with why your brain is wired to get this wrong. It's not a character flaw, it's a cognitive bias.
The planning fallacy. Kahneman and Tversky, 1979, first named it, first documented it systematically. And the finding is brutal in its simplicity. People systematically underestimate how long tasks will take, even when they have direct personal experience that past tasks took longer.
The key phrase there is, even when. That's what makes it a cognitive bias rather than just an experience. You can have done the same thing 10 times, it took 45 minutes every time, and on the 11th time you'll still estimate 30. Your brain just refuses to learn from the data.
Kahneman's own example is the one that always gets me. He was part of a team developing a curriculum and writing a textbook. They sat down and estimated it'd take about 18 months. Then he asked a colleague who had done similar projects what the base rate was. The colleague said, these projects typically take 3 to 5 years, and about 40% of them never finish at all.
And they still went with 18 months.
They still went with 18 months. It took 7 years. And Kahneman is the guy who named the bias. He knew about it, he'd studied it, and he still fell into it.
The mechanism he identified is the distinction between what he called the inside view and the outside view. The inside view is when you look at the specific task in front of you, the steps, the people involved, the plan you've drawn up, and you estimate based on that. It feels concrete, it feels like you're being rigorous. The outside view is when you ignore the specifics and just ask, how long did the last 5 similar projects take? That's it, that's the whole method.
And the inside view almost always produces a lower number. Because when you're imagining the steps, you imagine them going well. You don't imagine the server crashing, the client changing their mind, the kid getting sick, the traffic on the bridge. Not because you're naive, because those things are literally not part of the plan. The plan is a story about what happens if nothing goes wrong.
And here's the thing about buffer. Buffer isn't a nice to have. Buffer is the structural correction for a known cognitive bias. If you know your brain will systematically produce estimates that are too low, the rational response is to add a fixed margin to every estimate. That's not pessimism, that's calibration.
But this is where the pushback comes in, and Daniel named it perfectly. The productivity-obsessed brain says, if I add buffer and don't need it, I've lost that time. That's the voice that makes buffer feel wasteful, even when you intellectually know it's not.
And that voice has a friend. Parkinson's Law.
Right. Cyril Northcote Parkinson, 1955, writing in The Economist. Work expands so as to fill the time available for its completion. Give yourself an hour, it'll take an hour. Give yourself a day, it'll take a day. So the logic goes, if you add buffer, you're just giving yourself permission to dawdle. The task will expand to consume the buffer, and you'll still be late, just later.
And that's a real phenomenon, but it's been misapplied as a blanket argument against buffer, and it doesn't hold up. Parkinson was describing bureaucratic organizations where tasks have no hard external deadline. When a task has a real deadline, a meeting that starts at 10, a flight that departs at 2, Parkinson's law doesn't operate the same way. You can't expand a meeting into infinity because the next meeting starts at 10:30, and there's someone else in the room.
More importantly, buffer isn't about giving the task more time. It's about giving the transition more time. The buffer sits between tasks, not inside them. You're not saying this meeting will take 75 minutes instead of 60. You're saying this meeting ends at 11, and the next one starts at 11:15, and those 15 minutes are for the transition.
Which brings us to the research on task switching. The University of California, Irvine has done extensive work on this. When you switch from one focused task to another, it takes somewhere between 10 and 15 minutes to regain full concentration on the new task. That's not a personality flaw, that's cognitive architecture. Your brain has to unload the context of the previous task and load the context of the new one.
So the productivity-obsessed retort, 4 meetings times 15 minutes of buffer equals 1 hour lost. It's exactly backwards. You're not losing an hour. You're recapturing an hour that would otherwise be lost to context, switching costs. Without the buffer, you finish meeting 1, sprint to meeting 2, and spend the first 10 minutes of meeting 2 still mentally in meeting 1. That's the real waste.
And there's a term for what happens when you don't have buffer. Bridget Schulte, in her book Overwhelmed, calls it time confetti. Your day shatters into fragments. You have 30 small pockets of 5 or 7 minutes each, none of them big enough to do anything meaningful with, and you spend them scrolling or checking email because what else can you do in 5 minutes? Buffer is the opposite of time confetti. Buffer is intentional margin that prevents the shattering in the first place.
I love that framing. Time confetti is what you get when you optimize for maximum scheduled density. Buffer is what you get when you optimize for actually being present in each thing you do.
And there's another layer here that I think gets missed. Tom DeMarco wrote a book in 2001 called Slack, Getting Past Burnout, Busy Work, and the Myth of Total Efficiency. His argument, and he was writing about organizations, but it applies to individuals, is that slack, which is just another word for buffer, is when innovation and reflection happen. When you're running at 100% utilization, you're in firefighting mode. You can only respond, you can't think, you can't improve, you can't notice that there's a better way to do the thing because you're too busy doing the thing.
This resonates with me deeply. I nap a lot, as listeners know, and people think that's just sloth behavior. But napping is buffer. It's deliberate non-productive time that makes the productive time better. When I wake up from a nap, I see things I missed before. Connections become obvious. That's not laziness. That's how cognition works. You need gaps for the pattern recognition to kick in.
And the medical parallel here is actually quite strong. In clinical practice, if you schedule patients back-to-back with no gap, 2 things happen. 1, you run late all day and everyone waits. 2, you burn out in about 3 years. The gap between patients isn't wasted time. It's when you write notes, review the next chart, take a breath, and actually show up present for the next person. I learned this the hard way in my first year of practice.
How bad did it get?
I once saw 28 patients in a day with 5-minute gaps. By patient 20, I wasn't practicing medicine anymore. I was just moving through rooms. I don't remember half of those afternoon appointments. The notes were useless. I had to redo half of them the next day. The buffer isn't optional. Without it, you degrade.
So we know why we underestimate and why buffer is the fix. But how do you actually do it without feeling like you're wasting time? Here's the operational playbook.
The first step is embarrassingly simple, and most people won't do it. For 2 weeks, write down how long you think each task will take, and then write down how long it actually took. Every task, not just work tasks. Grocery store, commute, answering emails, everything.
Why is this the first step?
Because your personal bias factor is probably not what you think it is. Most people assume they underestimate by maybe 20%. The reality, in virtually every study that's looked at this, is closer to a factor of 2. People think something will take 30 minutes and it takes an hour. But you won't believe that until you see your own data. You need to confront your own estimates in your own handwriting.
And once you have that factor,
you apply it as a default. If your personal bias factor is 2, then every estimate you make, you double it. Not sometimes. As a rule, your brain will scream at you that it's too much. That's the inside view talking. The data is the outside view. Trust the data.
I did something like this years ago, and my factor was closer to 3, which is embarrassing to admit, but it's also liberating, because once you know the number, you can just use it. You don't have to have the argument with yourself every time.
The second step is Daniel's grandfather's rule, 15 minutes, but operationalized as a structural calendar practice, not a feeling. For every scheduled event, you block 15 minutes before and 15 minutes after. The before buffer is for travel, setup, and arriving without stress. The after buffer is for notes, decompression, and preventing the next task from starting late.
The after buffer is the one people skip. Everyone understands arriving early, but finishing early, or rather finishing with space, feels wrong. You finish the meeting at 10:45 and your next thing is at 11. That 15 minutes must be free time, which means you should fill it. That's the instinct.
And that instinct is what creates the cascading lateness. If you don't protect the after buffer, the meeting that runs 5 minutes long, and meetings always run 5 minutes long, pushes your entire afternoon. By 3 p.m., you're 20 minutes behind and you never catch up because there's no slack anywhere in the system.
What do you actually do in the buffer? Because Daniel's point about the lost hour is really about this. If you're just sitting there for 15 minutes, it feels like waste.
You pre-commit to a set of buffer activities, meeting notes, planning the next task, a 5-minute walk, reading a relevant document. The key is that these are defined in advance. They're not whatever I feel like. If buffer time has a default purpose, you won't drift into scrolling or low-value busy work. You'll use it for the thing it's actually for, transitioning your brain from one context to another.
I use my after buffer for what I call a brain dump. 2 minutes of writing down anything that's still rattling around from the meeting. Action items, questions, things I want to follow up on. If I don't do that, those thoughts follow me into the next meeting and I'm half present for the first 10 minutes.
That's exactly the context. Switching cost we talked about. You're externalizing the open loop so your brain can close them.
The third step is what I think of as the emergency buffer. For high-stakes things, flights, client presentations, anything where being late has real consequences, you don't use 15 minutes, you use 30, maybe more.
Why the extra layer?
Because the planning fallacy has a cousin, which is that we underestimate not just the task, but the variance. Things don't just take longer on average, they also have a wider range of possible durations than we expect. A 15-minute buffer covers the average overrun. It doesn't cover the day the highway is closed, and you have to detour through 3 neighborhoods you've never seen.
This is actually a statistical point. If you only buffer for the mean delay, you'll be late roughly half the time. To be on time reliably, say, 95% of the time, you need to buffer for something closer to the worst case.
This is where the emotional resistance really kicks in, because buffering for the worst case means you'll sometimes arrive 20 minutes early. The productivity brain sees those 20 minutes and screams waste. But arriving early isn't waste. Arriving early means you're calm, your heart rate is normal, you can review your notes or sit quietly or just not be in a state of low-grade panic.
There's a physiological component here that doesn't get talked about enough. When you're rushing, your cortisol is elevated. You're in a mild stress response. You walk into the meeting or the appointment with that stress still in your system, and it affects how you think and how you show up. Arriving early isn't just about punctuality, it's about the quality of your presence.
I want to go back to something Daniel said in the prompt. He mentioned that the buffer principle connects to his experience with preparedness, the unplanned move, the war. And I think that's actually the deeper layer here. Buffer in scheduling and margin in preparedness are the same thing. They're both about acknowledging that the world is more chaotic than your plan assumes.
Say more about that.
When you prepare for an emergency, you store water, you have a go bag, whatever. You're not doing it because you expect the emergency to happen tomorrow. You're doing it because the cost of being wrong is catastrophic, and the cost of being prepared and not needing it is a few gallons of water in the closet. Buffer and scheduling works the same way. The cost of being early is 15 minutes of quiet. The cost of being late is a cascading day of stress, missed information, and the reputation hit of being the person who's always rushing in.
The reputation piece is real. People notice who's consistently late. They may not say anything, but they form judgments about reliability and respect. Being on time, really on time, not sliding in at the last second, communicates something about how you regard the other person.
There's a specific technique I want to mention because it addresses the, but I'll just fill the time, objection head. It's called reference class forecasting, and it's basically the outside view made operational. Instead of asking, how long will this take me? You ask, how long did the last five similar tasks take? And you don't estimate. You look at actual data if you have it, or you reconstruct it as honestly as you can.
The power of this is that it bypasses the inside view entirely. You're not imagining the steps. You're just reading off a historical average. Your brain can't optimism bias its way around a number that's already on the page.
If you combine reference class forecasting with the two-week time log we talked about, you get a system. You log actual durations for 2 weeks. You calculate your personal bias factor. You apply that factor to all future estimates. And then you add the 15-minute structural buffer on top. That's not three separate things. That's one integrated practice.
Let me push on something. What about the person who says, I tried this, I blocked the buffers, and then other people scheduled over them? Because in a workplace with shared calendars, buffer blocks look like free time, and free time gets booked.
This is a real problem, and the solution is to name the buffer blocks something specific. Don't leave them as empty blocks on your calendar. Label them meeting notes, transition, prep time, or even just buffer. Don't book. People respect named blocks. They don't respect empty space.
If someone books over it anyway?
You decline or propose a different time. The buffer has to be non-negotiable, at least at first, because your brain is looking for any excuse to eliminate it. The moment you let one buffer get booked over, the whole system starts to crumble, because you've just proven to yourself that the buffer wasn't real.
This is the discipline part, and I think it's why most people fail at this. Buffer feels soft. It feels like a suggestion rather than a commitment. But if you treat it as optional, it won't survive contact with a busy week. You have to treat the buffer blocks the same way you'd treat a meeting with your boss. You wouldn't skip that because you felt like checking email instead.
There's another angle here that I think about a lot. The goal of all this isn't to be more productive. The goal is to be less hurried. Those are different things. You can be extremely productive and constantly rushed. You can also be reasonably productive and never feel rushed. The second one is a better life.
The distinction you're making. It's almost a quality of life argument rather than an efficiency argument.
The productivity frame assumes the point is to get more done. The buffer frame assumes the point is to be present for what you're doing and not have your nervous system activated all day. If I get three things done calmly, that's better than getting five things done in a state of panic. Even if the output is lower, the experience is better, and the work is probably better too.
I think about this with archery. When you're rushing a shot, you miss. The arrow goes wide, and then you have to walk farther to retrieve it, and the whole thing takes longer than if you'd just taken the extra 3 seconds to aim. Hurrying creates more work. It's not just unpleasant, it's inefficient in the literal sense.
That's a good metaphor. The hurried shot misses, and the retrieval time exceeds the time you saved by rushing.
In medicine, the hurried diagnosis is wrong, and the corrective work, the extra tests, the follow-up appointments, the second opinions, consumes vastly more time than the 5 minutes you save by not thinking carefully in the first place. Hurry is a false economy in almost every domain.
Let's boil this down to 3 things you can do starting tomorrow.
First, start the 2-week log, estimated versus actual for every task. It's tedious, but it's only 2 weeks, and at the end you'll have your personal bias factor. That number is the foundation everything else sits on.
Second, implement the 50-minute rule structurally. Block buffer before and after every calendar event. Name the blocks. Protect them. Use the after buffer for a specific activity. Notes, planning, a walk, so it doesn't feel like dead time.
Third, for high-stakes events, double the buffer to 30 minutes. Accept that you'll occasionally arrive early and recognize that as a feature, not a bug. Use those extra minutes for a breathing exercise or reviewing your notes. Arriving calm is worth more than arriving exactly on time.
The underlying reframe, the goal isn't to be productive in the traditional sense. The goal is to be present, unhurried, and in control of your time. Buffer is the price of admission to that state. You're not losing time. You're buying peace, and peace is expensive in a world that wants you rushed.
The thing I'd add, and this comes back to something you said earlier, is that buffer is where the good ideas come from. When you're not rushing from thing to thing, your brain has space to make connections. The solution to the problem you've been stuck on, the idea for the project you should start, the realization that you've been approaching something wrong. Those don't arrive when you're sprinting. They arrive in the gaps.
The real question is, what kind of relationship do you want with time itself? Do you want to be in a constant state of negotiation with the clock, always losing, always behind? Or do you want to build a schedule that has room for reality, for traffic, for interruptions, for the fact that you're a human being and not a machine?
What would it feel like to go an entire week without ever feeling rushed? Is that even possible?
I think it is, but it requires giving up the identity of being busy. A lot of people are attached to being rushed. It feels important. It signals that you're in demand, that your time is valuable. Buffer requires you to be okay with looking slightly less busy than the person next to you.
There's an interesting question about where this goes. As AI scheduling tools become more common, the tools could reinforce the buffer principle, automatically building in transition time based on your personal bias factor and real traffic data. Or they could optimize it away entirely, packing your calendar to 100% utilization because the algorithm can find a 3-minute gap and slot something into it.
That tension between efficiency and margin is a design choice, and most software defaults to eliminating margin because margin looks like waste to an algorithm. But margin is where the humanity lives. I'd rather keep my 15 minutes and let the algorithm be confused about it.
Thanks, as always, to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for making this show possible.
This has been my Weird Prompts. If you have a weird prompt you want us to tackle, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We read everyone.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.